Thanks for listening to the best of the Odd Couple podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern, 4 to 7 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Odd Couple at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
You're listening to the best of the Odd Couple with Chris Broussard and Rob Parker.
ESPN is going to release its documentary. Remember, there it's been all the talk is about this 10-part documentary that ESPN is going to do on the Bulls. Michael Jordan's last Chicago Bulls team that won the championship, you know, a second three-peat. And it's called The Last Dance. Well, the big news is that because everybody's home for the coronavirus, they are going to, instead of releasing it on June 2nd, they are going to do it on April 9th. I think it's a really smart business move. I mean, we may be home on June 2nd too, but man, I mean, you talk about a captive audience right now. It is the perfect time for them to release it. I think that's a great idea. And here's what I want to throw at you, Rob. Why are we so fascinated? And I think everyone's fascinated with the Michael Jordan Bulls teams. This is the second three-peat now. I have an answer if you want me to give you mine first.
Go ahead.
My answer is Michael Jordan was the best player ever, and we don't need to talk about that and discuss that. And also, I'm going to say that Bulls team, and I'm not saying the 97-98 team, but I'm putting that whole second three-peat together that had the nucleus of Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman. And you could throw in Ron Harper if you want. That Bulls team, Tony Kukoc as well, is the best team in NBA history. They won 72 games in 96. That was the most ever until Golden State went ahead and won 73. But unlike the Warriors, the Bulls finished the deal and won the championship. And then they went on a run where they won the next three, never went seven games. For those that want to say, well, they were perimeter oriented, how would they handle big men? This was the best era of big men in NBA history. They beat Shaq and Penny. And remember, Penny, the millennials might not know, Penny Hardaway, before his knee injury, was phenomenal. He was on his way to a Hall of Fame career, period, the end. So it's a healthy Penny. This is Shaquille O'Neal. They beat them in the playoffs. They beat Patrick Ewing in the playoffs. They beat Alonzo Mourning in the playoffs. David Robinson, Hakeem Olajuwon were in the West. They didn't have to play them in the playoffs, but they played them in the regular season. So they had bigs, a Luke Longley, a Bill Winnington, who weren't really good players, but they were seven-footers who you could, and they were bodies you could throw at big men, whether it was Kareem from the Showtime Lakers. Because remember, Rob, with the Showtime Lakers, it was the second half of Kareem's career. So for the last two, maybe three championships that they won, Kareem was past his prime. I'm not saying these bigs that, and you know, the Bulls had several others. Every year they get somebody, John Sally 1 year, Bill Bison Dele 1 year, Joe Klein 1 year to be that third,
yep,
third part of the three-headed monster. They just throw bodies at you and wear you down, pick up fouls and all that. And then they were devastating on the perimeter offensively and defensively. Rob, I think they were the best team ever.
It's hard to argue with that because of all the other elements that go in. Even though the Warriors won one more game, it pales in comparison because you have to finish the job.
Yes.
I don't care. You just have to. You know, I always talk about that.
Agree.
You know, getting up to the Playboy Mansion, hanging out on the stoop. Nope. If you don't get in, Chris, it's a failed mission. You didn't get there. And that's
right.
What the Bulls were able to do. They got in, they won, and it goes in with everything that Michael Jordan was attached to. you could talk about so many different players, but he was so special. And they use that term way too much nowadays to anybody. Oh, he's special. Oh, he's special. Oh, he's... No, Michael Jordan was really special. And I feel pretty happy that I was able to cover Michael Jordan during that time.
Right.
I was on the NBA trenches. Not that year, Chris. I was already a columnist by that time. But you know what I'm saying?
Yep. During his career.
Heyday. And I was in Detroit during that. I covered the famous Scottie Pippen game with the ice pack on his head. You know, where he didn't play that game 7, Chris, or maybe played a minute or whatever it was.
Against the Pistons.
And yep. I was at the Silver Dome. I covered that game. I was working in New York. I wasn't even working in Detroit then. I was there when he made that shot against Craig Elo. I could just go on and on and on. And I watched that whole era, and I knew it was something definitely special and different. And I think that's why people are attached. Michael Jordan will always be one of those iconic figures because there's perfection. And that doesn't mean that he did everything right and everything was... But the 6-0, won all 6 MVPs, and then all the other stuff that he did, the individual accomplishments as well. Yep. When you put it all together, it is something to behold. It is something to want to watch. It is something you want to cherish and remember. And all the millennials and all the young sports writers and sports analysts, Chris, who always are trying to prop up LeBron, and I'm not saying he's not a great player and all that, but the reason, and this is just my personal opinion, the reason they do that is they feel like it's hard to be that NBA voice and that NBA guy when you didn't see the greatest guy who ever played. You know, you got YouTube. Mm. I really believe that. So they want LeBron to be the greatest so that they can have that, you know.
So are you talking about, like, a lot of the writers now?
Yeah,
the younger
I do.
Writers,
all the younger writers.
Talking about more fans?
Who don't know Michael Jordan. You know what I'm saying? Really?
Yeah, and look, it's something
you think that's
natural,
crazy or
Rob.
No?
No, I don't think it's crazy. I don't know if it's because they consciously feel like we have to have, you know, seen the greatest player of all time to really be the aficionados that we want to be, or if it's just the natural inclination of somebody you saw.
But you know
you
what?
Know,
but here's
because you
the
and
flip
I,
real
we
quick.
Didn't see Oscar, and you know. So we don't talk about those guys as the best ever. Although a lot of these writers, they did see Jordan. They were younger. And they were younger. So usually when you see somebody as a child, it's an elevated image in your mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I just think, see, I never looked at it like that. Like, I didn't have to see Babe Ruth at all to just look at the numbers, Chris, during the time he played. I always look at it like that. I don't feel like I'm cheated or I didn't see some of the great players who played during that time, but I do recognize them and their accomplishments. In Michael Jordan's case, it's just so hard for someone to make a case against him.
Because, as you said, the perfection.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yep.
Like, what's the case? He won 10 straight scoring championships. He has the highest scoring average of anyone who ever played in the playoffs. He never got to a game 7. I'm trying to figure out where's the hole. There's 10 Hall of Famers we can name who never got a taste of a championship.
Because of him, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Chris,
where's the hole? No, there is none. You're out, and there's no hole in his game either.
There's no hole. He played defense. He changed from a dunker to an outside shooter.
There was a year he averaged 8 assists. They put him at point. He averaged 32, 8, and 8. Against hand checking, he became a great mid-range shooter, had a post game, was decent at the three-point line. I mean, again, nobody really paid that much attention to it back then. But
the other one is,
became pretty good at it.
The way that they played defense back then, and the Knicks and the Pistons, they beat him up.
Right.
You remember that? There were no superstar calls from Michael. If you went to the lane and you went to the lane, Michael Jordan or not, you were getting hammered.
Remember I said the other night I was watching the 55-point game against the Knicks. And there was a play where he beat Starks' baseline, went up for the dunk, and Ewing, to your point, hammered him. 7 foot Patrick Ewing hammered him. Jordan went down hard. It was just a foul. Not today, it would have, the game would have been stopped for 8 minutes. It would have been a flagrant, you know, two. Ewing would have maybe been suspended. I mean, it just, you know, that's just how it is. And he took all that. And I'm gonna say something else, Rob. This is for Rob G too, because he's, you know, he hates on the old school players. The Bulls were kind of, when you watch the games, like you watch in the 80s, the Showtime Lakers, the Bird Celtics, so on and so forth, and the game was very much centered right around the paint. And so there were a lot of times where guys would have wide open 18, 19 footers and not take them. You know, the defense was giving them that and they wouldn't take it. Then today, obviously, the game is really spread out. And it's nothing in the paint. It's all revolves around the three-point line. The 90s, if you watch it, was kind of the in-between. Like, it wasn't as close to the paint as it had been in the 80s, but obviously it wasn't as spread out as today. So you had kind of that in-between. The three-pointer was more prominent than it had been in the 80s. And I also think the athleticism in the 90s was better than the 80s, not as good as now, but it was like really good athleticism combined with team play. Like now you got a lot of athleticism, but not a lot of team play outside of a Golden State and the San Antonio and a few other teams. But then you had athleticism. I mean, the team that you could put up against the Bulls, Rob, is Golden State with Durant and Steph and Klay. I can make an argument that the Bulls of Jordan, Pippen, Rodman, Harper were more athletic than them. Don't you think?
I do. I really do. And I think I just think people are so caught up on what was going on in the circus and the Warriors that they just, you know, like wanted to always put them ahead. And I just don't see it. I really don't. With the way, and obviously it's two different eras, how you're playing, hand check, touching people.
Well,
I get all that. Yeah, I get all that.
And look, the Warriors were an all-time great team. I mean, I'm talking about the second crew with Durant, Steph, and Klay, and Draymond. I mean, that's a great team. There's no question about it. To me, that's the argument.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Odd Couple with Chris Broussard and Rob Parker. Weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
We are bringing in a guy that, I mean, my goodness, you talk about accomplishing a lot in life, and he's only like 32 years old. He was a great player at Florida State in the defensive backfield. And now he is a neurosurgeon after being drafted by the Tennessee Titans, a Rhodes Scholar. We are welcoming in Dr. Myron Roll. Myron, what's up, man? Welcome
what's
to the
happening?
Odd Couple.
Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Great to have Appreciate you on, man. First of all, thank you for what you're doing. You're on the front lines over at Massachusetts General Hospital, and you're a neurosurgeon, but you're dealing a lot with patients with the coronavirus, correct?
That's correct. You know, our neurosurgical floor has been transformed into a COVID-19 floor. Some of our neurosurgical patients who, you know, are post-op day 5 or 6 or whatever the case may be from some sort of cranial or spine surgery, they have symptoms of COVID. And so we've been testing them and seeing if they're positive or not. And then our hospital is just being, you know, hit with a lot of patients coming off the street with COVID-19. So the emergency department is being, you know, littered with patients like this. And, you know, we've had this surgery clinic at our hospital, Mass General, where all sorts of specialties from neurosurgery to OBGYN to dermatology, anybody really, if you want to help in the fight against COVID-19, you can volunteer to sort of man and triage these patients and help with the fight. So it's definitely something that's really happening here. And as neurosurgeons, we're doing our best to help in the fight too.
I know people are shook and just have never experienced this. I mean, you don't have to be around for the Spanish flu and what is that, 1918, in order to experience anything like this. But why don't you think people are grasping what's going on? Day after day, Doc, we get stories. A choir had a rehearsal with 60 people, 19 got the virus. Kids on the basketball court playing basketball, they had to take the hoops down to stop the kids from coming out to play. Spring break, kids mocking the virus and on the beach drinking. Why aren't people? Why don't they understand what's happening? Can you tell people what's happening?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a great question. I think a lot of it has to do with this opponent that you're facing. You know, if this virus maybe cause, you know, outward external manifestations of some sort of skin disease, right? You get boils or you get a disfigurement or something like that. People say, oh, I don't want that because I can see it, right? But this is sort of an invisible enemy that hits your respiratory system and really attacks some of the immunocompromised folks with pre-morbid conditions and older folks. And so that's one. And then two, you know, it's a certain subset that's getting hit the worst, right? And so if you're young and you feel like you're healthy and you don't have any of these conditions and you sort of feel like you're invincible already, you know, this sort of adds to the idea that, hey, I don't want to lose my convenience and I don't want to lose my lifestyle, so let me just live life how I'm supposed to. But that's irresponsible, and that's not how it should happen, because here in Massachusetts and Boston, you know, we're seeing a surge in patients that's going to happen even worse in the next week or two. And as healthcare workers, you know, we see the stress of our industry and this discipline just being really, really taxed with resources and bed space availability. And as neurosurgery doctors, you know, we're canceling and cases and turning our ORs into ICU. So it's serious. It's real. Everybody needs to take it that way. Even if it doesn't hit you or you're not in that demographic that's going to get most vulnerable to this disease, it's still, you still have to play a part and be a part of the entire team.
Dr. Myron Roll, former NFL defensive back, now neurosurgeon resident at Massachusetts General Hospital, joining the Odd Couple. We've all been told that the older people who may have, you know, be sick in some way are the most vulnerable. But I'm reading every day now people dying in their 40s, people dying in their 50s. Is it more of a threat to middle-aged or younger people than we all kind of recognize?
Well, what we do know is that it's novel and it's incredibly infectious. And so it could hit anybody and doesn't discriminate, that's for sure. But I think those folks who, even if they're younger, still have a history of, you know, some sort of condition that, you know, sort of takes away from their immune system, that prevents the body from fighting off and warding off some of the diseases. You know, our body has this natural system that it can fight off a disease, and then if it knows that disease or if it has seen that disease before, it creates another immune response for when it hits again. It can fight and know how to attack that specific disease. But if you lose that mechanism, or if that mechanism is not as strong as someone else, then regardless of your age, you can be hurt. And so, yes, the higher number of folks are the older ones who have pre-existing conditions, but it certainly hits younger people too, and that just adds to the sentiment that everyone needs to take this very seriously.
Here's the other thing too. This is the millennial pushback that I hear. More people die from the flu, and you know, they're just making a big deal out of this. That's what I always get. You know, people who want to use that and just say this is the media overhyping it. What is your response to people who use that as an excuse?
Well, I think that is somebody who has a short-sighted vision on this aspect, and certainly wouldn't be someone I think who's in the hospital on the front lines and sees what we see every single day, seeing the amount of patients coming in, the end of life and goals of care discussions that some of our providers, our brave providers, are having to have with some of these families. You know, intubating patients who come in with oxygen desaturations, needing to be bronched, or you know, all these different things that are real. And ask the families of those patients who are having serious respiratory distress and compromise if this is, you know, just a benign, you know, overhyped situation. It's really not. It's taxing. It's stressing people, American families and, you know, international families. My family in the Bahamas, you know, it's stressing everyone, and it's stressing our healthcare system. It's stressing our economy. And it's going to stress us as a society if we don't take it seriously to try to flatten this curve.
Myron, none of us obviously know the answer totally. But we're hearing everything from a Mark Cuban says he's hoping and thinking the NBA may be able to start in mid-May, to some predicting that we won't have an NFL season, which would obviously mean no baseball, no NBA as well. So
the Olympics has been pushed back.
Where are you kind of on this? Like, I know you don't know exactly, you know, it's impossible to know, but where are you kind of on when these leagues might be able to play?
Yeah, I'm on the more conservative side of things, certainly. I think it's ambitious to think that there could be an NFL season or, you know, finishing out the NBA season anytime soon. I think because there's so many people who we're going to see is coming in the next week or two, the healthcare system has to react and respond to it. You know, you have travel that's still occurring and you still have an opportunity to spread. You know, have places that really haven't been hit that hard yet that will see an increase in their patient number. And even, you know, another thing that's not really being talked about is not only the folks who have COVID-19 that have been positive tested, but all those who have other symptoms that are analogous or very similar to COVID-19, maybe pneumonia, maybe the common cold, maybe flu, or maybe some other upper respiratory infection that you sort of have to parse out and use resources to figure that out too. So I think if I was a betting person, I'd say, you know, we will not be back to normal for a couple more months just to make sure that everything is okay, make sure that we've given our epidemiologists, our scientists, our really bright intellectual women and men at the front lines of time to figure out how to manage this best and how to prevent it from happening again in the future.
And that number that's floating out there, and I think even the president said that if we get through this and 200,000 people die, we did a great job. Is that really what we're looking at?
You know, I can't speak to the numbers that he said, but I will say that 200,000 people have families and have had, you know, communities that cared for and respected them and they wanted to be a part of and they wanted to see another day, certainly. So as a provider, I look at every individual case and every individual person as being someone who has an opportunity to reintegrate with their family, reintegrate with community, and do something positive rather than having to have these end-of-life discussions or having, you know, the serious infection really take away from who they are and take away from the fabric of their family too. So it's real. It's on a personal level, and it needs to be looked at that way for sure.
Myron, there are a lot of people that have thrown out these scenarios where, you know, Jay Williams said today, I believe it was, that maybe you could sequester the NBA players on a cruise ship for 8 weeks or whatever it takes to play the season. Or some have said bring all the NFL players to Las Vegas and put them all in a hotel where they're, you know, they don't have any contact with the outside world, but they can play games. Is stuff like that realistic to think that you're going to be able to keep, you know, hundreds of people in one isolated area and none of them get the virus, you know, over a two or three month period?
Well, I think it's creative thinking for sure, and it's trying to figure out how do we, you know, resume our normal life and have some daily activity that you know, benefits us. We know, I played sports since I was six, so I realize the benefit of sport and what it not only does for the individual who plays it, but what it does for the whole community. It uplifts people. It brings us together. It does some things that other disciplines cannot. So I get trying to be creative and figuring out a way to do this, but unless you can ensure that all those people in a very tight-knit communal setting aren't infected and are exposed to other people who may be infected, you may just be opening up a nidus for infection, basically, if you have a very tight group that's sitting there and that's together and you can protect them and keep them isolated. But if one ends up getting infected, then you're just allowing this very infectious disease to kind of spread around. You might be taking one or two steps back. So it may take something creative like that, you know, that Jay was referencing to make this work. But, you know, it's just going to be a smart way of how we maybe delay and how we get around this disease, because I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. And again, I'm quite conservative as a healthcare provider that we just need to maybe put our convenience on the back burner for right now and put the health of our country as a premium at this point.
And the other part is mentally, even if you were to do something like that, what would that do to players to isolate them from their families, their loved ones, just to play a game? I hear what they're saying. I understand they want to have sports and the leagues want to get their TV money. But does that make sense mentally, like to do that to someone?
You know, that's tough. That's really hard. I mean, when I played in the NFL or when I played at Florida State, you know, these are big-time programs, big-time organizations, and there's no way that I could have gotten through a season, let alone a game, without the supportive structure of my family, my friends, my loved ones, my fraternity brothers, you know, people who are really close to me. And, yeah, you're right. You know, as we all know, the mental aspect of any sport is – maybe equally or even more important than the physical aspect. And if you're compromising that based on the fact that you want to, you know, resume the sport maybe prematurely, then, you know, you got to think, what's the risk and benefit here, and what's most important at this point?
That was Dr. Myron Roll, neurosurgeon resident at Massachusetts General Hospital. Great job, man. We appreciate the time and the information. We know you're busy, and we just appreciate all you're doing right there on the front line.
Thank you.
No, thank you guys very much for having me. I'm a huge fan. I listen to you guys often. Chris and I, you know, we've obviously met back with Jesse Jackson, so I'm very, very proud
frat
of you guys.
Brothers,
so thank you
too.
Very much.
Frat
That's
brothers,
right.
too. I'm one of those frat brothers.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
All right.
All right, you won't hold that against Chris. That's okay.
We'll see you, man.
All right, thanks.
All right, Rob Parker, word has it that you were the topic of discussion in New England today.
Yes.
Is that true?
It is true.
You
all
live
week,
for this, so go ahead. And
you know
and
I love every minute of
enjoy it.
WEEI in Boston, in you know. Well, you know, they had me on during, you remember the Super Bowl a couple of years ago? Had me on taking phone calls. They called me one of the top Brady haters. Is that what they call me, Chris?
Yes.
And
they are right.
So they had this week is Brady week up there. You know, they're looking for content, you know, trying to figure out. So it was Brady week, and today was about the top three Brady haters of all time. So the three hosts who do the afternoon show up there in EEI, and Christian Fourier is one of the guys. You remember Chris, we used to work with him at the other place. He was on
And we've had him on here.
First Take, but he's one of the hosts. And so he so they the three of them had three votes each, and they there was a consensus number one, but I had the most votes, and I wound up on everybody's ballot, the three guys. So I'm just taking that to consider myself the winner. I was not number one on anybody's list, Chris.
Or the loser. I mean, is that viewed as a win?
No, that's a win.
Hating on the greatest quarterback
it ain't
of
hate.
All time?
It's that they that's call it win? Haters. I call it,
oh,
I'm the
man.
Most.
Hate.
I consider myself the most objective
How?
Sports writer who's ever covered Tom Brady.
He's got six Super Bowls.
That's fine. I give him credit for being a great player, but I'm not bought in to this whole notion that he's the greatest of all time. Tom Brady has had a couple of stinkers in there. Tom Brady has been awful lucky. I'm the only one willing to pull back the covers and tell you and show you all the warts on Tom Brady.
Tom Brady,
it ain't a pretty sight.
He's led game-winning drives in every one of those Super Bowls. How's that a stinker? I don't care what your stats are before that. You lead the game-winning drive, that's not a stinker. How's that a stinker? Tom Brady has won six playoff games. Count them, six. Where he gave up, his defense gave up 28 or more points. No other quarterback in history has two. I mean, seriously, the Super Bowl he lost, he threw for one of the Super Bowls he lost, he threw for 505 yards, a record. And if Belichick's defense had been able to hold down a backup quarterback, he'd have seven Super Bowls.
Chris, he gave
How's
up the
objective.
He gave up the football at the within the last 2.5 minutes. Well, you always forget that.
Name a
he
player
gave
that's
up
had
the
a perfect
football.
Game.
He
name
he
a,
was
name a basketball
he was the GOAT.
Or football player who's had a perfect game.
When they won their first Super Bowl, also the Tuck rule, he coughed
that
up the football
was the rule.
And was given back
that
to him.
That wasn't a rule created for him. That was already a rule in place, and it was legit. What?
Did he fumble a football, Chris?
No, not according
yes, he
to the
did.
Rule.
Yes, he did.
Do you know what the Tuck rule was?
Yes. And
according
still,
to the Tuck rule,
no,
now he got rid of it now, which is fine.
Yeah,
but
because it was
time,
wrong, because it rewarded Tom Brady.
It didn't reward just Tom Brady. It rewarded several quarterbacks. And it was a rule. It had been in place like 2 or 3 years before Brady even fumbled. So what? I mean, it was the rule. I can't blame him for that.
I am the winner up in
I'm
Boston, WEEI.
It's hate.